In the last couple of decades, especially since 9/11, we've heard a lot about the term Taliban and Islamic terrorism and Al-Qaeda, ISIS, all these organizations. And we've heard a lot of news about these organizations, their operations, the kind of terrorism they've been spreading. But for a large number of people, that's it. They don't know much beyond the story of these terrorist organizations. Where do they come from? What's the ideology like? And what are they exactly trying to achieve? Are they political organizations or religious organizations? And all these questions matter because they've had significant impact on the geopolitics of the world. In fact, in many cases, the national politics as well, how countries would deal with these militant or terrorist organizations. So that has been the conversation. At the same time, going forward in the future, a lot of people don't understand what to do about it. These organizations, they keep reappearing, and then sometimes people from one organization move to another. And eventually you just see that there is a lot of radical Islamic organizations that you find all over the world. What's really the politics behind it? And what's really the story behind these organizations? So Ahmed Rashid, who is an author and a journalist, he's done a lot of work on the subject. He's written quite a few books, some of them even titled Taliban, and with different subtitles, of course. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. The one book called Taliban, with the subtitle The Power of Militant Islam in Afghanistan and Beyond. And this book really traces the roots of Taliban and its related terrorism in Afghanistan, and how does the organization operate at the ground level, what exactly it is trying to achieve, where does it come from. And if we understand these puzzles well, we can make significant progress in terms of solutions. So I would recommend that you read these works and make a really good analysis. You understand the subject well before you come to any conclusions, any sweeping remarks about a society or a religion or a culture, one way or the other. So that's the idea. And now I'm going to read some initial pages from this book, which really lay the foundation of the subject. So let's start. On a warm spring afternoon in the southern city of Kandahar, Afghanistan, shopkeepers were pulling down their shutters in preparation for the weekend. Heavy-set Pashtun tribesmen with long beards and black turbans tied tightly around their heads made their way through the narrow, dusty alleyways to the city's football stadium just beyond the main bazaar. Children, many of them orphaned and in rags, ran up and down the alleys, gesticulating and shouting with excitement at the thought of the spectacle they were about to witness. It was March 1997, and for 2.5 years, Kandahar had been the capital of the fierce Taliban Islamic warriors who had conquered 2/3 of Afghanistan and were now battling to conquer the rest beyond the country. A handful of Taliban had fought the Soviet Red Army in the 1980s. More had fought the regime of President Najibullah, who had hung on to power for 4 years after Soviet troops withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989. But the vast majority had never fought the communists and were young Quranic students drawn from hundreds of madrasas that had been set up in Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan. Since their dramatic and sudden appearance at the end of 1994, Taliban had brought relative peace and security to Kandahar and neighboring provinces. Warring tribal groups had been crushed and their leaders hanged. The heavily armed population had been disarmed and roads were opened to facilitate the lucrative smuggling trade between Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, and Central Asia, which had become the mainstay of the economy. The Taliban, drawn from the majority Pashtun ethnic group, which accounts for some 40% of Afghanistan's 20 million population, had also galvanized Pashtun nationalism. The Pashtuns had ruled Afghanistan for 300 years, but had recently lost out to the country's other smaller ethnic groups. The Taliban victories revived hopes that once again the Pashtuns would dominate Afghanistan. But the Taliban had also implemented an extreme interpretation of the Sharia or Islamic law that appalled many Afghans and the Muslim world. The Taliban had closed down all girls' schools and women were rarely permitted to venture out of their homes even for shopping. The Taliban had banned every conceivable kind of entertainment, including music, TV, videos, cards, kite flying, and most sports and games. The Taliban's brand of Islamic fundamentalism was so extreme that it appeared to denigrate Islam's message of peace and tolerance and its capacity to live with other religious and ethnic groups. They were to inspire a new extremist form of fundamentalism across Pakistan and Central Asia, which refused to compromise with the traditional Islamic values, social structures, and existing state systems. A few weeks earlier, in Kandahar, the Taliban had lifted their long-standing ban on football. The United Nations aid agencies, seizing a rare chance to do something for public entertainment, rushed in to rebuild the stands and seats of the bombed-out football stadium. But on this balmy Thursday afternoon, the beginning of the Muslim weekend, no foreign aid workers had been invited to watch the stadium's inauguration. No football match was scheduled. Instead, there was to be public execution, and the victim was to be shot between the goalposts. I had just got off a UN plane arriving from Pakistan and was told about the execution in hushed tones by depressed and embarrassed foreign aid workers. This is not exactly going to encourage the international community to give more funds for aid projects in Afghanistan. How do we explain the use the Taliban are putting our renovation of the football stadium to, said one Western aid worker. They also looked nervously at my colleague Gretchen Peters, an American journalist. A tall, lanky blonde with a broad face and chiseled features, she was dressed in a one-size-too-small shalwar kameez, the local dressing comprising baggy cotton pants, a long shirt that extended to below the knee, and a long scarf that covered her head. But that did not hide her height or her striking American looks, which posed a threat to every concept the Taliban held, that women should be neither seen nor heard because they drove men away from the prescribed Islamic path and into wild temptation. Whether it was a fear of women or their abhorrence of femininity, Taliban leaders frequently refused to give interviews to female journalists. ever since the winter of 1994, when the mysterious Taliban first emerged to conquer Kandahar and then swept north to capture Kabul in September 1996, I had been reporting on the Taliban phenomenon, making more than a dozen trips to Taliban strongholds in Kandahar, Herat, and Kabul. I was even more interested in trying to get to grips with who they were, what motivated them, who supported them, and how they had arrived at this violent, extreme interpretation of Islam. Now there was another Taliban surprise, both a nightmare and a gift to any reporter. A horrific event that made me tremble with both fear and anticipation. I had witnessed much death during the years of war, but that did not make it any easier to be a spectator at the execution of a fellow human being, and to view it as an entertainment shared with thousands of people and as an expression of Islamic justice and Taliban control was harder still. At the stadium, the Taliban first resisted our entry, but then allowed me in if I stood quietly at the touchline and promised not to talk to anyone. Gretchen Peters slipped in, but she was quickly ousted by a posse of panic-stricken armed Taliban guards who nudged her in the back with their Kalashnikov automatic rifles. By mid-afternoon, every seat in the stadium was taken as more than 10,000 men and children packed the stands and overflowed onto the sandy football pitch. Children played games of dare by running onto the pitch before they were pushed back behind the touchline by angry guards. It seemed as though the whole city's male population had turned up. Women were banned from appearing at any public events. Suddenly, the roar of the crowd subsided as two dozen armed Taliban wearing plastic flip-flop sandals, black turbans, and the male version of the shalwar kameez came charging onto the pitch. They ran alongside the touchline, pushing the playful children back into the stands with their gun barrels and yelling to the crowd to be silent. As the crowd quickly obeyed, the only sound was the Taliban's flip-flops. Then, as if on cue, several Datsun two-door pickups, the Taliban's favorite mode of transport, drove onto the football pitch. One pickup sprouted a tiny-sounding loudspeaker, the kind of seen on thousands of mosques in Pakistan and Afghanistan. An elderly man with a white beard stood up in the vehicle and began to lecture the crowd. Qazi Khalilullah Firozi, a judge of the Taliban Supreme Court of Kandahar, spoke for over an hour, extolling the crowd on the virtues of the Taliban movement, the benefits of Islamic punishment, and a full history of the case. Abdullah Afghan, a young man in his early 20s, had allegedly stolen medicines from Abdul Wali, a farmer who lived in their common village near Kandahar. When Wali resisted, Abdullah had shot him dead. After several weeks of searching for him, Wali's relatives tracked Abdullah down, arrested him, and brought him to the Taliban for justice. Abdullah was tried and sentenced to death, first by the Islamic High Court of Kandahar and then on appeal by the Taliban Supreme Court. These were trials without lawyers where the accused is presumed guilty and expected to defend himself. The Taliban's interpretation of the Sharia or Islamic law demanded the execution of the murderer by the victim's family, but not before a last-minute appeal is made by the judge to the victim's relatives to spare the murderer. If they granted mercy, the victim's family would receive blood money or monetary compensation. But how much of this interpretation of Islamic law by the Taliban is odd to the Sharia and how much is odd to the Pashtun tribal code of behavior or Pashtun Wali is what is disputed by many Muslim theologians both inside Afghanistan and beyond. By now, some 20 male relatives of the victim had appeared on the pitch and the Qazi had turned to them. Raising his arms to the sky, he appealed to them to spare the life of Abdullah in exchange for blood money. "You will go to Mecca 10 times if you spare this man. Our leaders have promised to pay a huge sum to you from the Baitul Mal if you forgive him." He told the relatives. As the relatives all shook their heads in refusal, the Taliban guards pointed their guns at the crowd and warned that they would shoot anyone who moved. There was silence in the stands. Abdullah, who had been seated throughout the proceedings in another pickup guarded by armed Taliban, was now let out. Wearing a bright yellow skull cap and new clothes, his feet shackled with heavy manacles, his arms chained behind his back, he was told to walk to the goalposts at one end of the stadium. His legs visibly shook with fear as he shuffled across the pitch, his chains clanking and glinting in the sunlight. When he reached the goalposts, he was made to kneel on the ground with his face turned away from the crowd. A guard whispered to him that he could say his last prayer. A guard handed a Kalashnikov to a relative of the murdered victim. The relative swiftly stepped up to Abdullah, cocked the automatic, and from a few feet away shot him 3 times in the back. As Abdullah fell onto his back, the executioner moved alongside his twitching body and at point-blank range pumped 3 more bullets in his chest. Within seconds, his body was thrown into the back of a pickup and driven away. The crowd quickly and silently dispersed. As we drove back into town, thin silvers of smoke arose from the bazaar as tea stalls and kebab stands lit up for their evening trade. A mixture of fear, acceptance, total exhaustion, and devastation after years of war and more than 1.5 million dead have forced many Afghans to accept the Taliban ways of justice. The next day, in a village near Kabul, a woman was stoned to death by a baying crowd after being sentenced for trying to flee Afghanistan with a man who was not her blood relative. Amputations of either one hand or one foot are common Taliban punishments for anyone caught stealing. When they captured Kabul in September 1996, to be initially welcomed as liberators, many Kabulis and the world turned away in disgust after the Taliban tortured and then publicly hanged former President Najibullah, the ex-communist strongman, who for 4 years had been living in a UN compound under UN protection. Since the end of the Cold War, no other political movement in the Islamic world has attracted as much attention as the Taliban in Afghanistan. For some Afghans, the Taliban created hopes that a movement led by simple Islamic students with an agenda of bringing peace to the country might succeed in finally disposing of the warlord factions which had devastated people's lives since the communist regime in Kabul had been overthrown in April 1992. Others feared that the Taliban movement would quickly degenerate into one more warlord faction determined to thrust despotic rule upon the hapless Afghan people. The Pashtun Taliban have also brought the question of inter-ethnic relations in a multi-ethnic state to the forefront, as well as other issues including the role of Islam versus clan, tribal and feudal structures, and the question of modernization and economic development in a conservative Islamic society. Understanding the Taliban phenomenon is made even more difficult because of the excessive secrecy that surrounds their political structures, their leadership, and the decision-making process within the movement. The Taliban do not issue press releases, policy statements, or hold regular press conferences. With their ban on photography and television, nobody knows what their leaders even look like. The one-eyed Taliban leader, Mullah Umad Muhammad Umar, remains an enigmatic mystery. After the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, the Taliban are the most secretive political movement in the world today. Yet the Taliban have inadvertently set a new agenda for Islamic radicalism in the entire region, sending shockwaves through Afghanistan's neighbors. Not surprisingly, Iran, Turkey, India, Russia, and four of the five Central Asian republics, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, have backed the anti-Taliban Northern Alliance with arms and money to try and halt the Taliban's advance. In contrast, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia have backed the Taliban. In the post-Cold War era, this has created unprecedented polarization across the region. The Taliban victories in northern Afghanistan in the summer of 1998 and their control of over 90% of the country set in motion an even fiercer regional conflict as Iran threatened to invade Afghanistan and accused Pakistan of supporting the Taliban. At the heart of this regional standoff is the battle for the vast oil and gas riches of landlocked Central Asia, the last untapped reserves of energy in the world today. Equally important has been the intense competition between the regional states and Western oil companies as to who would build the lucrative pipelines which are needed to transport the energy to markets in Europe and Asia. This rivalry has in effect become a new great game, a throwback to the 19th century great game between Russia and Britain over control and domination in Central Asia and Afghanistan.